are doomed to learn it the hard way.
Zarya Massacre. Mahadi can now walk and perform many chores, like fetching water for ablution to perform his five daily prayers. These were near impossible after the horror of the December 2015 Zarya massacre, where hundreds were murdered in cold blood. Hundreds like Mahdi received life-threatening injuries in the three-day carnage. Walking for Mahdi was a torturous experience. Almost 3 years after the unbelievable horror, Mahdi still sits to vividly recall the atrocity. He was one of those shot and burnt alive by soldiers of the Nigerian army at Sheikh Zazaki's house in Gelesu, in the northern Nigerian city of Zaria, on December 13, 2015. Mahdi said he stayed without food for 72 hours and only survived because of the generosity of a good Samaritan who hid him away from the predators. During the carnage, Aisha was trapped in an upstairs building as intense shooting by the soldiers in Gelesu raged. Aisha said she survived by the grace of God. She had spent over 2 years treating bullet wounds on her leg. I apologize for making her recall the bitter experience.
An armed soldier will now go direct and face a private part of a lady and shoot, where grenades will be thrown to women to go and scatter their bodies. It happened. So it's a brutality that a heart will never imagine. And I will never like to see it again. The eye that saw it will never like to repeat it. It's very, very sudden.
It is totally condemnable. It is alien to our law. And it cannot be accepted in any civilized society. More so that up till now, none of the murderers has been brought to book. Contrary to the recommendation of the Garba Judicial Commission for Inquiry and the white paper issued by the Kaduna State Government.
That on Saturday.
So Malama Amina Mustafa lost three children in the Zarya massacre. But above all, she lost her husband, who she said was a friend, a reliable confidant, and a responsible and loving spouse. Malama said she misses her husband every day. Back in 2017, during the International Quds Day rally in Kaduna, her surviving son, Hussein, was shot in the back by the Nigerian police. She said Hussein lost a lot of blood at the scene and eventually became paralyzed from the waist down. Hussein has since dropped out of school because none of the available institutions have infrastructural provisions for the fiscally challenged. She says caring for Hussein is a difficult task. Every day, Malama says she wonders at the viciousness of the Zaria massacre, especially the seeming absence of humanity in the perpetrators. Victims of the Zaria massacre live in many households in many cities in northern Nigeria. We visited many homes in Zaria and Kaduna. We moved from one house to the other, knocking on doors in the hope of listening to their accounts of what many described as the reprehensible crimes committed against their spouses, relatives, and friends. This is the family of Ibrahim Ahmed Badiko, who was killed in the Zaria massacre. He left 12 children and 3 wives. One of the wives was pregnant when he died. Now the children are 13 without a breadwinner. The Shuhada Foundation was conceived and established by the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki, in January 1992. It is now headed by Sheikh Abdulhamid Bello, who says the main objective for setting up the foundation is to cater to the needs of the families of the martyrs who lost their lives during the struggle to establish the cause of justice.
And from time to time, the clampdown, is increasing from time to time. So, but the worst one is what happened in this 2015, which we are registering almost 1,000 shuhada. As a result of the clampdown by this Buhari administration.
Most organizations depend on assistance from donors. However, Sheikh Abdulhamid says the Shuhada Foundation has different ways of raising funds for taking care of the orphans and families of the martyrs.
We have what we call the Shuhada dues. We have it every, it has started by 5 naira. Every member of the movement will give monthly 5 naira as a due. So, but now it has come to 100 naira per month.
The Islamic movement holds the annual Shuhada Day in order to remember the contribution of the martyrs, to assess performance and to find ways of restructuring the organization for better performance. Most of these orphans are children of the hundreds of members of the Islamic movement killed in the December 2015 Zaria massacre. The Shuhada Foundation says the task of catering for their needs has become even more challenging.
Before 2015, we have less than 300 children of the Shuhada that we take care of. But now we have over 2,000. You see, not even doubling, not even tripling. So, and from these children that they have increased in number, also their own demand is more than before. Because most of those 300 at that time, we have, in terms of education, for instance, most of them are in primary or secondary school. We have less than 10 that we are in the higher institutions. But now we have more than 100 who are in the higher institutions.
Assalamu alaikum. We arrived at the house of late Abdullahi Abbas in Zaria to meet the family he left behind. Abdullahi Abbas was killed along with his 3 sons in Gelesu, the residence of Sheikh Zazaki. His senior wife expressed a lot of gratitude for the work of the Shuhada Foundation. She expressed her grief at the loss of her husband and sons, but said the final judgment will be done by Almighty God. The accounts by victims of the mass murders in Zaria are varied. They also vary in their horror and intensity. But all the accounts are united by one common feature. They were heinous crimes committed against members of a minority religious group that were unarmed. Experts have continued to insist that the 2015 bloodbath in Zaria amounts to genocide.
Once you, in a reckless manner, unleash such advanced mayhem on a member of an ethnic group or a religious body, without any provocation, without any basis whatsoever, and more so, if they are unarmed, it's akin to genocide, which is a crime against humanity. And it's worse where the government refuses to bring the murderers to book.
Malama Zainab Sanusi still walks with a limp. She is also in perpetual pain because of bullets buried in various parts of her body. Malama Zainab narrated her harrowing experience in the hands of the soldiers who attacked the residents of Sheikh Zazaki in December 2015. Perhaps what was more despicable and cold-hearted, according to Malama Zainab, was when one of the soldiers threw a bullet at her as a souvenir. Counsel for Sheikh Zazaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who is also a human rights activist, says beyond trying to get justice for the criminality of the massacre, the surviving victims still have another avenue towards getting justice.
I've suggested to the Shia community to put together all the numbers of all the victims, identify them one by one, because the laws, our laws allow them. And I'm talking of the relations of the victims of the dead to ask for compensation. But what I'm talking about will be the civil action against the government, the federal government, whose army killed unarmed innocent civilians.
For about 3 years, Sheikh Zazaki has remained in custody despite the ruling of a federal high court in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. The court ruled that Sheikh Zazaki's fundamental human rights have been violated. It asked the Nigerian government to set him free within 45 days, to pay him compensation, and to build a house for him following the destruction of his house by the Kaduna State government and soldiers of the Nigerian army. The Nigerian government has not obeyed the ruling of the court. It has also turned a deaf ear to all protests and pleas for the release of the Islamic cleric to go for medical treatment. Sheikh Zazaki lost an eye during the attack and is losing the other one. In a twist, the Kaduna State government has arraigned Sheikh Zazaki on a Kaduna High Court. Sheikh Zazaki is charged with unlawful assembly, criminal conspiracy, and culpable homicide punishable by death. Members of the Islamic movement have rejected these charges. Many of the victims of the Zaria massacre have lost their jobs. Some, like Aisha Yakub, have been forced to drop out of school, while others have been divorced from their spouses because of almost 3 years of separation due to detention in prison. These serious issues have raised questions about human rights in Nigeria.
It's not rocket science to respect the rights of people. These are not illiterates or dropouts. These are well-educated people. And you need to respect their feelings, their views, and engage them in serious discussion. You can't crush them.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria strongly believes that an international conspiracy was responsible for the 2015 Zaria attack and the subsequent persecution of the Shia community that has continued up to now.
If you remember, the Saudi Crown Prince was in Saudi Arabia some months back, and he granted interview to the Time magazine. There, he listed his achievement, 3 years' achievement. And there he said, crushing the Shia's influence in Nigeria. He mentioned Nigeria specifically. So it's not a mistake for anybody to say it was planned by Israel and America and sponsored by Saudi Arabia, implemented by a mass murderer.
Whatever the reasons behind the 2015 Zaria attack, some experts believe that the global enemies of Islam must be smiling with satisfaction at the outcome of the events regarding the Islamic movement in Nigeria. These attacks and crackdown, experts explained, are not good for the global unity of Islam.
Unfortunately, some leaders in the Muslim world are dancing to the tunes of their enemies, you know, by deepening the crisis and stoking, you know, this conflict that continues to fractionalize as well as divide, you know, Muslims of different faith.
There are many pending issues regarding the December 2015 massacre in Zaria. For example, who is going to answer for the 347 men, women and children killed and buried in a mass grave on the outskirts of Kaduna?
As for those who did this shameful act, it's for them to be brought to book and be punished according to the law. Alhamdulillah, we have a case in the International Court of Justice, that is the ICC. We want the incoming government to give... to hand them over to ICC whenever they need arises. And certainly, the Islamic movement will not hesitate to take them to court again within the country.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria also alleges that there are still dozens of girls abducted by the Nigerian military and hundreds of others who are still unaccounted for. Darul Rahama, during the 2015 massacre, was among the several properties of the Islamic movement that was desecrated and destroyed by the Kaduna State government. Members still visit the cemetery to offer prayers to their fallen members.
Our situation is worse than the one found in Israel. There is no human being or no group, I mean, that was oppressed or is being oppressed, as I'm talking to you, like the Shiite community.
We made several trips to the offices of the Attorney General and the Nigerian Minister of Justice and wrote several letters in order to get the response of the Nigerian government regarding the issue of the Shia Muslims, especially the case of Sheikh Zazaki. But the minister did not respond to our request for an interview. The Nigerian military and the Kaduna State government were also unwilling to grant interviews on the matter. Meanwhile, protests, both at home and abroad, have continued as the Nigerian Shia community demands for justice from a democratic government that has sworn to be fair to all Nigerians.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden's upcoming trip to Palestine in July will serve as yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Israeli regime is working hand in hand with the U.S., says Mitchell Plitnik, author, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration continues to disregard the Palestinian people. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. When Joe Biden won the 2020 election, little was expected of him regarding the struggle for Palestinian rights. He had the advantage of replacing Donald Trump, who had surpassed his predecessors in supporting extreme Israeli regime goals, so he was bound to look good by comparison. Being better than Trump is an extremely low standard, and while Biden has met it, he has been better than Trump only by the thinnest of margins. In fact, Biden has managed to fail to meet even the lowest expectations he himself set. While he has not taken major steps in the Zionist regime's favor as Trump did, the day-to-day lives of Palestinians continue to deteriorate under his watch. His upcoming trip to the occupied Palestinian territories and the West Bank in July is unlikely to change that. The rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration has been as consistent as it has been empty. They have consistently stated that they support a two-state solution and they want to take steps to ensure equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and dignity to Palestinians. But the administration's actions directly belie that statement. The absence of any attempt even to seriously discuss Palestinian rights with the Zionist regime demonstrates that clearly. And the specific examples are too numerous to list. Recently, the United States rejected a Palestinian Authority request to restart peace talks based on the 1967 borders. That should comport with Biden administration policy, but they refused based on the precarious political situation in the occupied territories where the coalition government has lost key votes, is now in the minority, and is fraying quickly. A Palestinian source told the Israeli regime daily, Haaretz, that they, meaning the Americans, talk as if only Israel has a cabinet and public opinion that has to be considered. What about Palestinian opinion? And what about the aggression against Palestinians? The American attitude about aggression toward Palestinians couldn't be clearer than it has been since the Zionist regime's killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghila. despite at least four independent, fully transparent investigations by CNN, the Associated Press, Bellingcat, and most recently, the Washington Post, the Biden administration continues to call for an independent, transparent investigation, which is clearly code for an Israeli one. The Biden team has simply dismissed the eyewitness testimony of Palestinians who were with or near Shireen when she was killed, for no apparent reason aside from their being Palestinian. No doubt, Biden will, during his July visit to Beit Lahm, rebuff Palestinian inquiries about the killing and simply repeat to the Israelis that they want a transparent, independent investigation. Instead of addressing the apartheid conditions and daily severe human rights violations Palestinians are continuing to endure, the Biden administration tossed crumbs to the Palestinian Authority by, for example, upgrading the Palestinian Affairs Unit to the U.S. Office of Palestinian Affairs and having it report directly to the State Department rather than to the U.S. Embassy. Biden has made it clear that he will not take steps to undo the damage Trump did by moving the embassy to Al-Quds, nor will he revoke the United States' illegal recognition of the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The administration is, on the other hand, laser-focused on expanding the Abraham Accords and plans to use this trip to move Saudi-Israeli regime relations forward toward normalization. Biden insisted that the planned meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who Biden once called a pariah, was not about energy prices, but this is an obvious lie. Biden will go to MBS, hat in hand, and plead for lower energy prices and cooperation with the fake regime of Israel. But the Saudi king Salman remains opposed to normalization with the Zionist regime outside the framework of the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, and the Saudis are already coordinating with the Zionist regime on security matters. So Biden is demeaning himself for what will likely be no reason, as OPEC has already announced plans to increase oil production in July and August, an increase which is likely to be reversed in time for the U.S. primary elections in November. Meanwhile, the Palestinian people face an ever-tightening occupation, yet one would see no indication of this in Washington. If Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken started their term reluctant to rock the Israeli boat, they're now terrified that anything they do that plays poorly in the occupied territories risks toppling the cabinet of Naftali Bennett and could lead to the return of Benjamin Netanyahu. With Democrats already poised to lose big in the midterms and Biden's popularity at historic lows, they don't want an Israeli regime prime minister who will actively work with Republicans to further diminish the Democrats' position. That means throwing the Palestinians even further under the bus. It means ignoring settlement expansion, the increasing violence of settlers and the Israeli troops and police, and congressional letters calling for the president to try to stop the mass evictions of Palestinians in Masafer Yatah. And it certainly means turning a blind eye to the ongoing apartheid. Mm-hmm. Biden's trip in July is not likely to do much for him or for the United States, but it will be yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Zionist regime is working hand in hand with the United States. And whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House, that isn't going to change.
Yani?
32. Bazaar.
The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week, we will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC, and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Given its large oil reserves, it's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry. Various manufacturing sectors heavily depend on petrochemical products such as home appliances, plastics, and even textiles. The government aims to further develop polymer industries and other downstream sectors of the oil industry. Doing so would increase revenues through exports and help bolster the country's economy.
According to the National Polymer and Petrochemical Institute, Iran ranks first in the region and globally ranks 18th in polymer production. Moreover, output in this sector accounts for over 2% of the country's non-oil exports. We looked at some figures from the National Association of Polymer and Plastic Industries to get an idea of how this market is doing. Well over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced each year. Half of this amount is domestically used, and the other half is exported, valued at $3 billion. In addition, exports of products made from polymers in complementary industries are worth around $2 billion. However, industry participants say that the country is not using all of its production capacity. Figures from the National Association of Polymer and Plastic Industries show this sector has a production capacity of 20 million tons, meaning around 14 million tons of this total production potential are not being used. The government plans to double current production levels over the next 4 years to increase exports. Officials say meeting this goal will make Iran self-sufficient in polymer production.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country. Gathering around food is an ingrained part of almost all cultures worldwide. It's hard to imagine going to a wedding ceremony without its endgame dinner. Many celebratory and ceremonial events include food. Eating is not only necessary for survival, but also it is seen as a pastime and a way to get out with friends and family. For many, it is also a source of income. And the food industry is driven by the tastes of various customers, making it one of the most profitable industries in the world. This week, we venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on baking equipment. We will explore the industry's national and international markets to get an idea of some of its significant activities. Also, we will touch on subjects like agriculture to understand its role in national food security. To familiarize ourselves with the types of equipment needed in the food industry, we visited Barak Industrial Company. With 40 years of experience in manufacturing, this company specializes in the mass production of machinery and equipment needed to bake bread. Some of these machines are pretty large and can weigh up to 7,000 kilograms, taking up large spaces in a room. This company has expansive production facilities with high output to manufacture such massive machines. Most of the raw materials for production at this company are purchased from inside the country. For example, the manufacturer buys steel sheets, wires, and plastic components from other manufacturing companies. It then shapes these raw items for the desired machine components in its production halls. This company employs dozens of people directly. It also offers training to its staff to keep up with the various new production methods and produce new machines. In the food industry, competition is driven by high-quality food that comes in a diverse range of attractive products. Lucky us customers. The machinery used to make these items also need to be flawless to produce items that satisfy us, the customers. Consequently, companies expand their product lists to match their customers' varied tastes while introducing new items. So machines are essential to the ecosystem of the food industry. As bakery businesses must adhere to food safety standards, the machines and equipment used to produce food products must match these standards too. Aside from food safety standards, these machines must be dependable with quality assurance. If a machine fails, a baker may not be able to sell their goods, which reduces profits. For this reason, this company also follows manufacturing standards set by the National Bureau of Standards and International Standards for production. Due to the high yield of this manufacturer, it not only supplies bread-making machines to domestic customers, but also exports its items. In addition to exporting its products to neighboring regions, it sends its items to countries in Europe, among other destinations. This manufacturer employs industrial engineers and designers to create various machine models. It has also generated numerous job opportunities indirectly. the company has often found a creative solution to the challenges it has grappled with over the years. Some include the availability of raw materials necessary to make its machines. Other challenges are optimizing its marketing strategy to find new customers to increase its reach. However, one of its major hurdles has been the US-imposed sanctions, which have hindered international money transfers, impacting global exports. Speaking of bread making, Iran is a nation of bread eaters. I'm one of them. In fact, official figures show Iranians consume some 160 kilograms of bread per capita. We better keep exercising. That's the highest in the world after Turkey. Many Iranian foods are meant to be eaten with bread on the side. So, Iran produces massive amounts of bread daily to supply this domestic demand. Based on figures from Iran's Bread Association, industrial-scale bread making holds 20% of the market and is mainly handled by machines. However, locally known as naan, traditional bread has more demand and is usually baked in tailored ovens. Around 80% of flour distributed nationwide used to be government-subsidized until this year, meaning the government was providing part of the costs for flour to be sold at lower prices in the market. One of the reasons for removing subsidies is said to prevent people from smuggling wheat and flour out of the country. On another note, flour is also used in many other foods, which the country also exports. For example, biscuits, confections, and so forth are made in large quantities with a production capacity of around 2.5 million tons annually. That is going off of figures from the National Biscuit, Confectionery, and Chocolate Producers Association. In 2019, exports stood at $800 million, and in 2020, this figure dropped to around $450 million. Industry participants say this decline was mainly due to the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Recent figures have not been published yet. The food and beverage industry is probably the most important part of the country's economy, accounting for over 20% of Iran's non-oil revenues. That's according to the National Chamber of Commerce. Nearly all food products produced in Iran are made from raw materials from domestic agricultural cultivation. That is why Iran has a very robust agricultural industry. However, agriculture is not admitted to farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Products in this sector are considered strategic as they can be processed into other items, garnering more profits. Figures from the Ministry of Agriculture show the country has over 18 million hectares of arable land. That's land that can be farmed. Last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced on farmlands. The agro industry is worth billions. Data from the National Customs Administration show the value of agricultural exports rose by 8% last year. Figures show Iran exported roughly 7 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $5 billion in the same period. Industry analysts say last year's exports declined compared to 2020, when the value was around $6 billion. They say there are several reasons for this. One is a government ban on exports of certain agricultural products, such as potatoes and aubergine, to supply domestic demands. This year, however, the ban was lifted. Another reason for the decline in exports is said to be reduced production. This was because of the coronavirus pandemic and less than average annual rainfall, coupled with outdated farming practices. All things considered, this sector has a promising future, particularly with the development of new technology used for cultivation, harvest, and processing.
Well, it's that time of the show where I should step aside because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you a wonderful, exclusive report. Take it away.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here for the first time on Bazaar. The process that we are checking out today is called plating. Well, it's not actually called plating, it's just very similar to plating. I just thought that that's the name that you had heard. It's actually called PVD, or physical vapor deposition. But it's similar to plating in that it's essentially adding a layer of metal on a material, maybe to harden it, maybe to for decorative purposes, but mostly for decorative purposes. So this is the process that we're checking out today in this edition of Bazaar.
The company we're checking out today started their journey by producing microelectronic parts, such as vacuum pumps, vacuum tubes, pressure sensors, and the likes, but they quickly realized that a better way to implement the tools that they're manufacturing is to actually use the parts to assemble a machine to do coating in a much more sophisticated way rather than selling the individual parts. They found a much better market making those machines and getting clients to coat various objects and materials in their machines, or even selling the machine itself to clients so they can run a coating business themselves. Here's how the process works. Once the objects we want to coat are loaded into the chamber, blocks of titanium are loaded onto the cathodes. The anode is the entire chamber itself. Through small holes in a pipe inside the chamber, argon, a neutral gas, is injected. Argon is the preferred gas for the process because it doesn't chemically react with either our titanium block or the loaded material. At this point, the chamber is turned into a vacuum chamber to allow for the gas to flow more easily in it. The argon is ionized, so it moves towards the cathodes that have the block of titanium on them. And it moves at such a speed that it vaporizes the titanium. And now the titanium in the gaseous form is ready and primed to sit on our material in the chamber, especially since the particles of the material have expanded due to high temperature in the chamber, making it easy for the titanium atoms to go and sit in between the particles and stick to it easily after they've been taken out of the chamber at room temperature after cooling down. In every part of the world, decor takes a different shape. What people spend money on to make their houses look good is different. Gold has always had a special place in Iran, which makes it understandable that we, perhaps more than the average person in a lot of other countries, would like to have ornaments that have that shine, just without breaking the bank.
Us humans love shiny things. We tend to value them more highly than their non-shiny counterparts. But, you know, gold tends to be a little bit more expensive than, titanium or pretty much any other metal. So because we can't have something this big that is made out of actual gold that shines, we do the next best thing. We coat it in gold, aka titanium and nitrogen. Personally, though, I prefer things to be more matte, but that's just personal preference. But obviously, there's a market for these shiny ornaments and furniture and candlesticks. So whether it's a gold shine or a silver shine that you're looking for, I think now you have a much better idea of where these things get their shine from. But anyways, thank you for staying tuned for another edition of the Bazaar.
Many thanks for that adventure. Wonderful stuff. Let's dive right into some news and trends now regarding this polymer industry and its upstream and downstream sectors. The world of polymers is vast due to its multiple applications in science, technology, and even pharmaceuticals. Now, Iranian researchers have formulated a new two-dimensional polymer, which is part of the category of coordination polymers.
The new chemical compound was generated from zinc and organic binders. Coordination polymers are a new class of materials that have gained much attention from global industries. Its unique properties offer potential in many fields, such as organic and biochemistry, materials, electrochemistry, and pharmacy.
I hate to say this, but plastic pollution is getting the whole world in hot water. In Iran, plastic bags have the highest share of plastic waste generated annually. More and more people are now saying no to plastic bags, with the National No Plastic Bag Day fast approaching.
This annual event happens on July the 11th, coinciding with the International Plastic Bag Free Day. Each year, on this day, several programs are carried out across the country to raise awareness about plastic pollution and the benefits of recycling. Plastic bags make up 500,000 tons of all plastic waste produced in the country each year. That's according to the Environment and Sustainable Development Department of Tehran Municipality. It might be interesting and also disturbing to know that almost every piece of plastic ever produced still exists today. It takes around 450 years for one plastic bottle to dissolve.
Well, that covers our programme for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The fiancé of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi said on Sunday, 19th of June, that she was very disappointed in President Joe Biden's plan to meet with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who the United States has determined ordered the operation that killed Khashoggi in 2018. The article you're about to hear has been written by ABC News journalist Ben Gittleson. The piece is titled, Slain Journalist's Fiancé Slams Biden for Plan to Visit Saudi Arabia. The fiancée of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi said on Sunday, 19th of June, that she was very disappointed in President Joe Biden's plan to meet with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.